Welcome to the Drum History Podcast. I'm your host, Bart Vanderzee, and today I'm joined by Uli Salazar from Ludwig. Uli, how are you, man?
I'm doing well, Bart. Very excited to be a guest here on your podcast. I've been listening for quite some time now, and definitely love a lot of the features that you do, so I'm pretty stoked to be here.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, you come highly recommended from our mutual friend and Ludwig artist, Stephen Wolf. I was telling you before, he has like since day one recommended you. So this has been a, it's been in the works for a while in my mind. And we met at PASIC. I was checking out the Ludwig booth last year, which was awesome. Very cool to see everything you guys have going on there.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really awesome to connect. Stephen is awesome. He's just been a really good, great ambassador for Ludwig over the years that he's been on the team. Obviously, he's been a massive fan of the brand and the product for years, and has used it in a lot of his projects. But yeah, we've definitely spent some time going down the gear rabbit hole and just talking about gear ad nauseum sometimes.
Yeah, I'm sure. Which that's what this is all about right now.
Totally.
So yeah, today we're talking about the Black Beauty. Which is one of the most famous and kind of sought after snares in the world. Growing up, it just seemed like to me, it was this like mythical snare drum, like almost like I remember being like a kid and like, you know, I was in that age of like, I was born in 90. So being into like Pokemon cards or something and equating it to like finding a Black Beauty. It's this rare, super rare thing, which it is. So, why don't you just kind of tell us all about it? And because it didn't start out named as a Black Beauty, obviously. So take it away, my friend.
Yeah, yeah. The what's now known as the Black Beauty actually came out in 1919 as the Inspiration model. It was available in a few different size, in a few different sizes, mostly different depths. They did do 15 inches. It was a six lug drum originally, but evolved over time to be available as an eight lug and as a 10 lug. There's a lot of things about the build of that shell that has changed over time. But overall, the thing that really makes it unique is the brass alloy. Obviously, the black nickel plating aesthetically is just jaw dropping. And so that's where it got its nickname from. And obviously the center beat, there's just, you know, something sort of timeless about that complete package of that drum, that as it's existed in our catalog over the last 100 plus years, it's definitely taken it's definitely built quite a big fan base. One of the things too to note about the center beat, that was actually an industry first by Ludwig, as well as the side lever throw off. Really? Amongst many things, but yeah, the center bead spec on a metal shell was Ludwig was first to do that.
Now, what is that? What is the purpose of the center bead? What does that do?
The center bead has a few purposes, but its primary purpose was for support. The shells back then were tack welded at the center. I think maybe John Aldridge talked about this on your podcast as well. But yeah, so back then, the early brass shells that were beaded were tack welded just under the bead there to join the two top half of the drum and the bottom half, essentially.
Okay.
And that helped keep the drum in round. It definitely made for a much more better point in the shell to butt the two halves together. And so really that's kind of how it came about. But interestingly enough, that also had played a role into the sonic characteristics and performance of the drum. And really anytime you do anything to a drum, you modify it in any shape, way, or form, it's going to respond in a specific way. And it may be good or it may be bad. And I feel like a lot of the times, you know, there was an intention that Ludwig went after in a specific design, and they landed on an augmentation to the drum 9 times out of 10, which is cool. So there's a lot of happy accidents, I feel like, in a lot of the innovation that went on at Ludwig over the years. But now today, through like really understanding the principles of the build and working with the engineers and things like that, we really start to understand what a lot of these components and elements in the makeup of a specific drum does and how that plays a critical role into the overall performance and sound of the drum.
Yeah, that's awesome. But I mean, in 1919, I'm sure it was more, let's kind of figure this out, because that was very close to the advent of the drum set.
Oh, totally.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So you said it was called the Inspiration Model at first?
Yeah. So it was introduced as the Inspiration Model, and that name for it didn't last too long. It was offered, it was cataloged for quite a few number of years as the Inspiration Model, but the drum that sort of got the wider recognition just because of the overall presentation of the drum was obviously the Deluxe Model with the engraving mm-hmm. and things like that. So the Inspiration Model was just all solid black nickel plating gotcha. All the way around with brass trimming. And by 1923, they sort of played off of that same theme of the Inspiration Model and introduced a deluxe drum. And they threw a few more things at it, you know, obviously like the engraving. They added different lug configurations to it as well. And that sort of caught more of the attention of players because it not only did it capture this really rich sound that brass is known to have, it just had such a really unique and really jaw-dropping presentation to it.
Yeah, the I don't know, the engraving, there's something about it that I think everyone just loves, which, I mean, it's kind of like maybe Ringo's drum set as well, but it's one of those things where it just you think of Ludwig when you think of a Black Beauty, which I guess we'll get there, but it's kind of ironic because you guys were not the first people to coin the term Black Beauty, right? That was Slingerland, I believe. Hey guys, I want to pause here real quick because what I just said about Slingerland being the first to manufacture the Black Beauty was actually incorrect. A friend of mine, Nate Testa of Testa Beat Drums and the official Snare Geek on Instagram, out of the blue sent me a message saying, hey, check this out. It was an article about the George B. Stone Drum Company in a 1925 article has a Stone Deluxe drum outfit that features a 4x14 Black Beauty separate tension snare. So as far as I know, George B. Stone Drum Company was the first to actually coin the term Black Beauty. Now going off of a catalog from 1928 about Slingerland, they have a snare drum called the Black Beauty Artist Model, which is actually an engraved snare drum. So I think, you know, you can take it for what it's worth. 1928 Slingerland Black Beauty engraved metal drum. 1925 George B. Stone wood snare drum separate tension Black Beauty. And I will post in the show notes the information about these so you can actually see the articles of the George B. Stone catalog from bostondrumbuilders.com and then the Slingerland article from coopersvintagedrums.com.
I guess we've had the bigger fan base to that specific drum, and we had our version of doing it as well. And through the years of sort of these older 20s drums really having such a cult following to them, there was obviously the name thrown around because all these old catalogs didn't exist. Nobody knew what it was really called. I guess so. You see a drum, and you know the first thing that came to mind to some people was it's a black drum and it's beautiful. So
that's pretty true. Yeah, you can put that together pretty easily.
Yeah, no doubt. Actually, back in I think when they reissued the drum in the late 70s, there was a I do remember I have a copy of this somewhere in the house too. There's an ad where Ludwig sort of writes the story of how that they adopted that nickname, and it was through some band director calling out, to the percussion, a snare percussionist in the ensemble, really calling out that drum, and he would be like, hey, you know, play that beautiful drum, that Black Beauty drum. That's what you got to play.
Oh, that's cool.
So yeah, there seems to be kind of a story that the Ludwigs had and also talked about when they reissued this drum and what made it special and how the naming just had a pretty cool backstory to it as well.
Yeah. No, so you just said, and we'll keep going down the line, but you said reissued because like there's different eras of Black Beauties where they're more like people always say they want the Black Beauty. And then you look at like a 1928 one, but what they really want is like a 70s Black Beauty or something like that for different like makeup of the metal, which don't let me get ahead. We can get there, but
for sure.
Yeah, take it away from there.
kind of going back to the early 20s and walking along the timeline. So by the late 20s, obviously Ludwig had hit some hardships as William F. Ludwig, as it being a family brand, they had to sell it off to Seiji Kan, who at the time owned Lady. So mm-hmm. just before that, you know, a lot of what they had offered in the catalog kind of went away. I'm not exactly sure. I can't really speak to that. I don't know the facts of why they chose to no longer make the deluxe drum and things like that. But it seems like they definitely manufactured quite a bit of these throughout that period of sort of its first time being offered. And throughout the years, it obviously landed in the hands of some pretty well-esteemed drummers. And, you know, just like anything else, when you hear a lot of captivating performances and compelling pieces of music being played, a lot of the times, you know, if you're a musician yourself, or you know, you're gonna ask the question, hey, what'd you use on that? You know, that you know, your performance sounded so great. Like, obviously the playing had a big part to do in it, but you know, how did yeah. the instrument sort of influence that as well? And so through sort of word of mouth, you know, I think the word got out that, you know, this drum was a thing, and it sort of built its clout out in the marketplace and things like that. So yeah, after Ludwig had sold, obviously he still remained part of the operation, but I think, you know, it sort of cooled down the promotion of this drum. But at the same time, I think there was sort of an underground brewing of clout and reputation and hype for this drum, you know, for the you know, three or so decades to come, you know, post 1920s.
Yeah. Now, did WFL continue to make the Black Beauty under the WFL name?
No. Obviously brass was the primary alloy when it came down to metal snare drums. The first the first Ludwig all metal shell was a brass nickel plated shell. So the earlier Ludwig metal shells from 1912, I think, is when the first all metal shell came out. And onward, those were, or through the early 20s before the inspirational model came out, or the inspiration model came out, those were all nickel over brass shells. Okay. So the alloy was always brass. And when WFL drums started their operations and they were making brass or metal shells, they were still using the brass alloy, but I don't know why they favored the nickel plating over the black nickel plating, but it seemed like that kind of became a standard look for so many years when they used a brass alloy, and obviously when they switched over to aluminum, they tried to capture that same luster and tone of that luster by chrome plating it, things like that. So
gotcha, that's interesting. And I'm sure there was, like, I don't know, my WFL dates that well at this point, but like, I'm sure there was some wartime stuff in there as well, where they weren't making metal drums in that, you know, late 30s, 40s period.
Oh yeah. So yeah, totally. Yeah. They really had to sort of retool their factories and redesign things so that they weren't incorporating a lot of metal during, the era of World War II, and which was the WFL era. So that's where you saw like drums with wood lugs and wood hoops. And I think the only metal parts really were screws here and there. Mm-hmm. But even down to like tripod stands and things like that, those were all like wooden based and stuff. So it's pretty cool to see the evolution of drummings, of drums, because obviously, you know, back in the early 20s, the technology and the approach and the understanding of all this stuff was still very primitive. And as it was kind of forced to evolve, you know, basically they kind of reacted to, the things that were just accessible and available at any given time. And a lot of times that meant that they would have to, look at alternatives and alternative designs to sort of, be able to achieve a lot of the same product that they were offering or people, you know, were demanding, at this time. So it's always super fascinating to me. I guess I'm like a really big, like, sort of history romantic in that sense.
Yeah.
And you are too, obviously. So
yeah, for sure.
Now I understand why Wolf connected us. But yeah, it's that era, you know, post 20s, it was kind of it was pretty dark as far as, you know, there wasn't really much happening with the Ludwig name and the Black Beauty drum. You really kind of have to fast forward to the late 70s.
Cool. Well, then go ahead and fast forward. So, I mean, I'm sure at that point still people were like using them. The drums didn't just disappear. So I'm sure they still, you know, showed up with, I guess, a lot of the users of this time from 1919 up until, you know, through the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s would be like jazz guys, big band. It would be that type of application, right?
Yeah. I want to say, you know, I could be wrong on this assumption, but I want to say that, you know, I think it found itself mostly in the scene of orchestral players. Throughout its existence. And that was a really big scene back then. Like, when you think about like what the big music scenes are now, and it's like, you know, rock bands and stuff like that, you know, obviously yeah. Jazz had a thing where, you know, it was the prominent genre and category of music. But obviously orchestra players, you know, they had a very big audience back then. And I think a lot of these drums existed in that particular genre because of the way it performed. It was very responsive. It was very sensitive and articulate, especially at low volumes. You know, one of the big things with orchestras, it's very dynamic driven. Like, these compositions rely on the push and pull of dynamics. And that's a drum that you're able to do that with time and time and time again. And I think that's really where it started finding its principal footing. And I think from there, I'm sure other musicians and drummers, you know, talking to their counterparts and things like that and their peers and saying, you know, try this drum for, you know, a jazz gig or whatever. And I'm sure it landed on a handful of primary jazz gigs as well. But I think there was undoubtedly a knowing and a recognition of the significance of this drum and its performance, without a doubt.
Yeah. Before we jump ahead to the 70s, mm-hmm. let me ask you about, and John Aldridge obviously talked a fair amount about it, but like, were they always engraved? Like, why don't we talk about the engraving a little bit? Like, how did that come about? Was it a single person doing it, like the 1920s version of John Aldridge? Or what's the story with that?
Yeah, I don't know too much of the specifics, like somebody like John would. You know, I sort of leave that expertise to him. I mean, he's done it for so many decades now. But I do know that it came to fruition in 1923. And at that point, that's about 4 years into the existence of the Inspiration format. So, it transitioned into that particular drum. And really, when you look at a lot of these, there's a lot of intricacies and differences in scrolling as well within the mm-hmm. time period of deluxe drums. You know, you have different scrolling of the leaf. You know, in different ways that certain corners were done and things like that. And I think that sort of represents a different, you know, whoever, you know, probably, you know, three or whatever, you know, different engravers at any given time, maybe. But each one kind of had their own specific stroke. And noticing the differences in a lot of the strokes and the pedals and in a lot of the other designs, I think, you know, those are obvious indicators that, you know, there could have been multiple hands doing this at any given time. But that it's really cool though to know that there was, you know, quite a few different people that were that skilled to do, you know, a really unique decorative sort of craft like that, which is fascinating. And that particular thing is what makes all of those drums really special, because at the end of the day, it really is one of a kind. You know, it's a, you know, specific year, specific person doing it, specific, you know, different design and things like that. And I think that's why so many people cherish those drums. It's that it sort of, each one has its own identity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember John talking about how at this time it was very like, it had to do a lot with gun engraving, which was really popular at the time, and it had that kind of swirl and all that stuff, which you can definitely see, like, on, you know, like an old rifle or something like that. It totally makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that was definitely a skill that existed amongst, you know, metal workers back then. So I don't know that it was a very rare thing, but I think it was really cool that they sort of transitioned from doing it in probably where it existed the most is in guns, and to do it on snare drums. People were probably looking at drummers kind of weird at that time. It's like, what are you doing? What are you trying to achieve here? And then once they saw the final product, they're probably like, holy smokes. Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. That's unbelievable. Yeah. And so people know we're talking about a previous episode with John Aldridge, who is a amazing drum engraver, drum tech for REO Speedwagon. And he is the founder of Not So Modern Drummer. And there's a previous episode with him, which you can find, that says the history of drum engraving, just so you know. So, all right, well then that's cool. So why don't we fast forward then, like you said, into the 1970s, remembering that, I guess it just wasn't being produced from that time where Kahn bought Ludwig and WFL was out on his own until the 70s. Is that right?
Yeah. So sorry if I misspoke on this too. So the early part of the 30s, most of the 30s rather, it seems like the drum still existed at that form of being an engraved drum. So it really wasn't until the 40s, which is around the time that that William F. Ludwig left, and I don't know if that was an influence to this existing during those earlier years of C.G. Kahn owning Ludwig. But yeah, from about 1941 to about the late 70s, I believe 76 to be exact, would be when production of that particular drum or a version of that drum didn't exist under the Ludwig name.
Okay, cool. It's funny how you just said a version of that drum, because you read my mind thinking, do you just like find the recipe book and then like start making it, or how'd that go?
So 1976, when they went back to this concept of this black nickel brass shell, they basically followed a lot of the format that they were making current metal shells at this time. Obviously, the brand and mechanisms of these drums, like the throw off and things like that, have evolved in design and adapted new technologies and form and function and things like that. So when you look at the Black Beauty from 1976, they basically took the format of the Superphonic, which at that point they had been making for a little over 10 years now. So they ended up utilizing the Imperial lug, which we saw in a lot of metal drums. As I think that lug came into play in the early 30s, right about the time of the 25th anniversary. And that lug, I want to say that it was a William F. Ludwig design. However, when he started WFL Drums, he wasn't using the Imperial lug. It was the C.G. Kahn owned Ludwig that was using the Imperial lug. But when William F. Ludwig bought the name back, it seemed as though he was very stuck on bringing that lug design back under the now reestablished late 50s Ludwig brand. And that's why I think it was a design that he sort of had a hand in putting together. Because I would imagine if it was something he didn't do and it was, he would sort of leave that behind and focus on, a new design or things like that. But I could be wrong. But no less, by that time, when he gets the rights to, or essentially buys his name back from C.G. Kahn in the late 50s, they go through a variety of different metal shell models that they develop. Obviously, the Super Brass and the Super Ludwig. Those are some of the earliest post 1930s imperial metal shells that you see, and those are both brass shells. One was a nickel plated brass, and the other one was just a polished brass shell. And then they kept going with that same format with a center bead shell, imperial lugs, and then came the Superphonic in the early 60s, and I believe it's 1963-64. When the Super came out. And so, you fast forward, obviously the Super built a massive fan base throughout the 60s, and even into the 70s. So by 1976, they basically had a tried and true format of imperial lugs, beaded shell, and by this point, you know, they started messing with the super sensitive throw off was in existence, and obviously the P85 had a number of years behind it as well. So those drums that they ended up producing in 1976 sort of took on the format of Superphonics, but just with a different shell. And the shell that they used basically was built under the same principles of those aluminum shells. They were seamless, seamless shells, center bead with the same flanged bearing edge and the same shaped snare bed. Now, as opposed to the early 20s or the 20s models and the Inspiration model, the Deluxe model, those were two-piece shells. So now you got a complete seamless shell. And, you know, just by looking at understanding the design principles of those drums, I sort of feel like it was probably much time efficient to produce a single sponge shell as opposed to tack welding two pieces together. Like, I just sort of seemed like that was probably a little more time consuming.
Was that because of the technology of that day that they couldn't do the spinning, or was it like just you don't know what you don't know kind of thing?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure. I don't know if anybody was spinning shells that early on. I'm sure there was some metal work taking place that was utilizing some form of spinning. I would imagine cymbals, obviously.
Sure.
But definitely. So it just seemed like, you know, whatever formula they had at the time, and they were at a point where they had a pretty tried and true formula through the Superphonic, as far as manufacturing goes, that they basically adopted a lot of those components and principles, but just changed the alloy, and they went back to alloy, or to the brass alloy.
Now, this is probably just a stupid question, but are they basically the same drum except the alloy, like you're saying? I mean,
kind of. What makes them different is the thickness of the shell. I think influences the primary difference between the two. And that's a big component in a design that contributes to the overall sonic performance of a drum.
Okay.
So the brass shells, the Black Beauties compared to the Supras, were slightly thinner. And that sort of opened up the drum a little bit more and made it more responsive and sensitive, and sort of emphasized a lot of articulation at low volumes because of that. That sort of helped that out. Whereas opposed to, you know, going a little bit thicker, you sort of tighten up the sound a little bit more, add a lot more focus, and it's not as responsive at that point. So,
which is probably great for recording, which is one of the reasons why the Supra became one of the most recorded snares in history, which, as opposed to having this, you know, snare that probably, like the Black Beauty, takes more effort to dial it in for a recording.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah.
All right, that's awesome. So now knowing that they're different in that way is really cool. So at that point in time, what kind of players would be using the Black Beauty? Because earlier on, it was the Symphonic guys, because of the openness and the sensitivity. Was it similar in the 70s?
I think they still catered to that genre because of the super sensitive technology that existed with the super sensitive throw off. And so it became a very revered drum because of it had the sound and the operation and the functioning of a drum that just made a lot of sense for that setting. And then on the other side, you had the more standard lever throw off, which was convenient for a lot of rock guys. You know, they weren't really too, I don't think that they were really too specific about like a lot of the minute subtleties, because like you said, you know, in studios and things like that, control and focus really go a long way. And whereas in an orchestral setting, you're playing really large rooms, and you have to, you really have to carve out presence in really specific places And to have a drum that does that, like a super sensitive model type of brass shell, you know, that becomes a go-to tool for that application. Yeah. So it was kind of cool that they did that. And they also had different snare strainer types, even in the 20s as well. There was a more basic lever throw, but they had a, you know, obviously more advanced sensitive type throw off mechanisms and things like that. So it was kind of cool that, you know, as rock evolved to be, you know, to sort of accept and want a more simpler instrument, there was also still a demand and a need for a very detailed and instrument that had a lot of these components where you can really fine tune the sound.
Yeah.
Because they're definitely in tune with something like that. And obviously brass has been utilized in instrument manufacturing for many years with horns and things like that. So the reason why brass, you know, always existed in drums, I think is obviously because of its rich tone. You know, it just had sound that was pleasing to the ear and added a nice contrast to all of the other sonic elements that exist within in an ensemble and an arrangement, which is really, really cool. So, I think again, it kind of evolved, and it took its form naturally, by the time it got to the 70s. And it was very appealing, to a much larger variety and type of player. And by then, obviously, you had so many genres of music compared to, you know, the 1920s. Yeah.
Definitely. Can you explain a little bit about, I know this is the Black Beauty episode, but can you explain a little bit about the super sensitive, like that whole system? Because I know Buddy Rich loved it. Just take a break and talk about that, because it almost has like the Dynasonic kind of like big, like extended frame around it. How does it work? Is it similar where you tighten, you know, it's not actually connected and all that stuff?
Yeah, so the super sensitive system, basically what it's trying to achieve by principle is not bow the snare wires. It wants to press the wires in a nice, even, linear way. Whereas opposed to the more traditional like swing side lever throw off, that starts to tend to bow the wires because the tabs fall, you know, they don't extend beyond the snare bed or the outside of the shell, whereas the super sensitive wires extended, the tabs extended a little bit further. So they designed a device that basically pulled that system from both sides upward without bowing it. And by doing that, you don't restrict the vibration of the snare wires. And again, going back to the orchestra type players, I mean, they want as much response and even response of those wires as possible, whereas opposed to when you're bowing them and cutting those wires a little bit shorter from the outside of the shell, you kind of start to choke and prevent that particular effect in a drum to really do its job completely. But again, there's a drummer for that. You know, there's a type of player that wants that sound and wants that perform and function out of a drum. And there's definitely a setting for it. So, you know, there's pros and cons to both depending on which type of player you are. But luckily, I mean, with the Ludwigs have always been so deep into music and players themselves, they sort of understand, I feel like a lot of what they offered in their catalog was an effort to understand all sides of the spectrum of a player and bring out some of the best solutions to help a variety, not just one type of drummer, but a variety of different type of players, the performance style that they were looking for.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, because it's not about what you may like. It's about, obviously, about your customer. And if I say like, well, I don't really like orchestral music, I'm not going to make something like that. That's not right. You're missing out on a huge amount of, you know, obviously customers, but obviously too, you're just alienating people. So that's a good way to look at business.
Yeah,
which totally. I'm sure you guys still do today.
Yeah, I was just going to say that too. Those are still the fundamental principles in thought that we follow when we design drums. This era of Ludwig and all of the key guys to designers and sales managers and directors and marketing guys and things like that. All of us are drummers and we come in with, you know, some of, you know, a lot of us obviously have our innate taste and style and perspective on things. But a lot of the times we sort of have to know that that needs to be curbed for the greater yeah. thought of what we're doing. And I always say this about the brand, like this is Ludwig is the people's brand, you know, and it's always yeah, been sure. that way. Even when the founders, you know, ran the company, and we don't stray from that. You know, we listen to our customer base, we listen to dealers, artists, educators, and that, you know, we develop products for them, you know, because at the end of the day, I'm not the one buying all of our stuff. I mean, I love buying drums and I got a ton of drums, but you know, my tastes aren't going to be the same as somebody else's, and my taste might not be as mainstream as some other things. So, you know, we really leave it up to our fans to really, you know, steer the ship. It's not about us on the inside. Yeah. And a lot of people think that, well, you know, it's the guys with the ties, and we don't wear ties, so
there's no ties.
Yeah, so let's kill that thought. I really love this brand because our fan base, and I still consider myself a fan of this brand, even though I work for this brand. But I was a collector for years before coming here. But a lot of how we operate is based off of our fan base, and we have a lot of loyal fans, and we're very grateful for that, because it really it just makes the whole essence of this operation that much richer, in my opinion. When you got people engaged in what you're doing, and you're taking ideas from people that really appreciate the brand and really appreciate what you do, you know, people don't want us to come up with like the next whiz bang technology. Mm-hmm. They do want us to move forward and be contemporary, but they also don't want us to forget about the past. And I think we've done an extraordinary job of that. And I even think that, you know, the chief did an extraordinary job of that when he was head of the operation throughout the late 60s and 70s. And the Black Beauty was proof of that. You know, he brought back mm-hmm. a drum that didn't exist in the catalog for almost three decades, but he saw the importance of it. He saw the cult following that sort of came to fruition from this drum over the decades of its absence, and gave the customer what they wanted. And the cool thing is we're still doing that.
This episode is brought to you by Forks Drum Closet, Nashville's full-line drum store. Celebrating its 40th year in business, Forks is independently owned and operated in the heart of Music City. Specializing in drums and percussion, Forks offers great discounts on all major brands and will beat any retailer's advertised price. From new and used equipment, vintage drums, and marching and orchestral instruments, Forks has something for every drummer. They also offer professional rental, repair and restoration services, as well as drum lessons. Stop by their storefront at 308 Chestnut Street, Nashville, Tennessee. Call 615-383-8343 or go online at ForksDrumCloset.com. Yeah, obviously you can still get Black Beauties now, which is awesome. So, and I agree with everything you just said. There's you know, my first real drum set was a Ludwig. It was like a 9 or 10 piece rocker set, which was, you know, I think I paid $700 and I got that. And then a Zildjian, like an A medium ride, which I still have, pair of new beats, which like, I mean, those two symbols alone are like worth, you know, a close to that amount of money. So, and I recently rebought another Ludwig rocker set going down memory lane, and it just kind of sat in the corner. So I traded it for the microphone I'm using right now. It's nice. Kind of funny. But okay. So yeah, I love Ludwig. But now getting back on the timeline here. So that's the 70s. Was it business as usual in the 80s? I mean, things got a little different in the 80s with all the electronics and all that stuff. But did Ludwig stay true?
Yeah. So production, obviously we faced our fair share of challenges throughout the 80s, you know, as you mentioned, as electronic drums sort of came to rise, and also, you know, the import brands or the overseas companies sort of gaining really good footholds in the marketplace and things like that. Definitely challenged US manufacturing pretty significantly. But no less, yeah, the Black Beauty from 1976 lasted to about 1981. And they did do iterations of this drum with the engraved styling as well. But these were mostly machine engraved. So the sort of the detail that you saw in those early 20s drums wasn't necessarily captured in the machine engraving attempts. You know, they definitely played off of the same design theme and elements with the flowers and things like that. But it just didn't have a lot of that hand scrolling, you know, that you find in the early 20s drums. But people still love that drum. And, you know, obviously around this time, I mean, you think about that time period of 1977 through 1981, and just think about all the countless, like, just solid records that came out then, but also how much music evolved at that point. You know, you had so many more genres by that, compared to like 1965. By the time you get to 1976, it's like, holy smokes, you know, jazz has evolved to like a whole new thing. Rock is a whole new thing. And you got this thing called disco and punk rock, you know? So
yeah, music, it's a different world.
Yeah. Music really took quite a crazy turn, but no less, even around that time, you found the Black Beauty still it having a pretty dominant presence in a lot of musical works from back then. You know, you think about, I was talking to Wolf about this. I was like, man, what records do you know that the Black Beauty was on? And he talks about, you know, Omar Keem on the David Bowie Let's Dance record. And he's like, it's on quite a few songs on there, if not, you know, the lead single off that. I know Topper Heaton of The Clash used a super sensitive Black Beauty. You know, so you covered like such a wide spectrum of music like that, and not to mention whatever else was going on. And that drum definitely found its way into a lot of, you know, really historic studio sessions. But I think by around this time, even though that production window was very short lived, for the Black Beauty to like catapult and amplify as, you know, its sort of clout as this next level drum, there was just so much action happening in music then, that I think this drum got so heavily utilized that it built up, even though, you know, it only existed for, you know, another small number of years, during that iteration of it. By then, like, I think that drum took off like a wildfire, and you know, it didn't take too much time after that to reintroduce it again. so by, I think it was 81 that they stopped making that drum. So they reissued it, you know, not reissued the exact 20s drum, but they rebrought the concept of that drum back to the market in 1976, lasted to 1981. And then by 81, obviously the brand had to reconfigure its product portfolio and things like that as it was trying to sell off to another corporation. And luckily we got picked up by another musical entity, which was the Selmer Corporation at that point. And that merge happened through the years of 1983 and 84. And that's when we moved operations from Chicago to Monroe, North Carolina, which is where we operate out of today. And also remember that a lot of the manufacturing that went on was mostly done under the Ludwig roof, as opposed to OEMing stuff with different vendors at that time. Ludwig was probably one of the biggest drum operations, one of the biggest product portfolios for drum set to exist, and even percussion, you know, obviously owning Musser and things like that, and Ludwig doing timpani. But they did almost everything, a lot of the metalwork, a lot of the casting for lugs.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's rare.
Yeah. I know that they outsourced a little bit of metalwork to local suppliers. Coincidentally enough, my uncle owned a factory that did some metalwork for Ludwig throughout late 70s and 80s. My cousin used to deliver their orders to the old plant stuff. It was
that's awesome.
Yeah, it was so weird to like come across that. You know, after I started working for Ludwig, I told my uncle about it. He's like, "Oh yeah, that used to be our account." I was like, "What?"
I was like, "Dude, why didn't you tell
me?"
Yeah,
exactly. It's like all these years, like you knew I was a drummer.
Yeah.
So and so by that point, you know, they kind of have a, I would imagine, you know, when they sold that off, they started to focus on things that were the easiest to manufacture that sold at the highest rate. You know, obviously with being a big company like that, that's kind of how you prioritize. You prioritize with your big movers, and you prioritize with the things that you could be most efficient with in manufacturing. And I think that's the direction that they headed in. And that would give them a little bit of time to really evolve at that point too, because now they kind of go back to the catalog. A few new people come into the picture, like Jim Catalano. He came in around that time, who's a dear, dear friend of ours, mentor, and he's family without a doubt. But if you guys don't know about J-Cat is the right-hand man to the chief, Ludwig II. Yeah. He really brought him under his wing. And he was the torchbearer for the Ludwig brand, and the catalyst behind this brand really continuing to exist up until today, without a doubt. But anyway, J-Cat, also a drummer. So the great thing was that, you know, even though the company sort of changed ownership, you know, the keys were in the hands of a man who was just as passionate about drums and drumming as its founders. And he's an educator. And he's really a drummer. He's the drummer that does everything. Timpani player, cool. Vibes player, you name it. And he is a pro at all of it. So he's teaching at Notre Dame now. He's doing awesome, and he's still very connected in the music community as an educator, and still is Ludwig through and through, without a doubt. But anyway, so J-Cat, being a drummer himself, I think started to obviously recognize an answer to the people, because again, this is the people's brand. And by 1988, the drum makes a comeback. So it's just a short number of years that, you know, we cease production of this drum. But the interesting thing about the era of drums from 1988 to 91, the Black Beauties then were offered with two different types of alloys. Throughout the 80s, Ludwig consistently made metal drums out of bronze and aluminum. Those seem to be some of the best moving metal drums for them through and through. So that's kind of what they continue to offer throughout pretty much all the 80s.
And that would be like the Acrolite, and then I'm assuming like the Superphonic would still be sold at that point, right?
Correct. Yeah, Acrolites, Superphonics, and then you had the Bronze Phonic that came out in the 80s. Cool. There was some standard snare drums that they did that were like I think those were welded though, but no less, they were still making those out of aluminum. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, so the Bronze Phonic came into existence, and that had such a very big following. Alan White of Yes was like one of the biggest faces for that drum. So a lot of the stuff in the 80s from Yes was on a bronze drum. He actually still uses that same drum.
Cool. Yeah, if it works.
Yeah, exactly. And
man, I didn't know it was like so much like it, you know, in 1976 it's back in to 1981, and then 88 to 91, it's kind of like I was just thinking it's like the McRib or something.
Yeah. Right?
You better get it when it's here.
The Shamrock Shake, it's back. it's the Shamrock awesome. Shake of snare drums. I love it.
Exactly. That's great.
Yeah, so 1988, yeah, it comes back, and again for another short period to 1991. And those drums you find being a combination of either bronze or brass. And they're stamped underneath the butt plate. There's a BZ if it's a bronze model, and there's a BR if it's a brass model. Those were offered in, you know, the different depths and sizes, as well as the throw-off combinations. And there was a new style of engraving on these now. They didn't do so much the machine engraving. I think that era of drums was the first that Aldrich started doing for Ludwig.
Okay, I think you're right, yeah.
Yeah, and then there was a few more other guys, and also a gun engraver too that was local in North Carolina, who also did a few. So even that era of drums, because you had a few different hands doing the scrolling work, is a little bit different too, because obviously everyone had their own touch and flair with the tools. So
yeah.
But yeah, that's a very short window there as well. But the bronze of that era, the bronze version of the Black Beauty, it seems to be like the unicorn, like the one that's like the gotta have drum if you can find it.
Now, what like sonically is different from the bronze to the brass?
The bronze is a little bit more of a brighter alloy, but it's just as responsive and sensitive as brass. It's just not as dark sounding.
Got it.
So yeah, it just has something special just because of the brighter presence that it has.
Gotcha. And they were still black. So it was black nickel over bronze.
Yeah, they looked identical. Like, you really can't tell them apart. And that's why they stamped them.
Cool, man. So then, and that was in the early 90s, right?
Yeah.
88 to 91.
Yeah, 88 to 91.
Okay, cool. Then how long did that Shamrock Shake phase go before it came back?
I love that. I want to say it may be the 2000s is when it comes back. I'll have to ask J-Cat, actually, to be 100% certain, because he'd be the one that brought it back both of those times. but it looks like it was by then. And the manufacturing of it also evolved. That's the one thing you got to understand about that drum, is that it went from being a tack welded shell to being a sponge shell to then being a deep drawn shell to now a hydroform shell, which is the best version. And I'm trying not to be biased. Like, I'm not saying because I work for Lubbock today, but having experienced, you know, each one of these in the past, you know, there's something unique to all of them for sure. But for those of you that don't know, I guess I'll explain a sponge shell and a deep drawn and a hydroform shell is. But essentially, a sponge shell is just taking a flat disc of metal and you kind of spin it into shape using some, you know, kind of lever device that you spin over a molded figure of sorts, and you sort of spin it into shape. Now, some of the cons about that is that you're putting a different amount of friction and heat to that alloy every time. And when that drum is completely done and 100% cured, there's a lot of inconsistencies in the way it's cured from the top of the shell to the bottom of the shell. And so that has a tendency to affect the integrity of the shell in general, as far as roundness goes, and as far as the final shape that it takes. And that could vary from operator to operator too, and in the way that they handle spinning the drum. So they're like cymbals. Those particular drums tend to sound different one after the other. You know, no two are completely alike. And that's why, you know, when people find the drum, like, it's the drum, you know?
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
And I know a few cats, you know, studio techs that, you know, have a Black Beauty and they're like, no, this is the Black Beauty. It's not just a Black Beauty. It's the one. And
yeah, like John said, if you find one that's in perfect condition, it's probably not the one.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, exactly. And the cool thing, you know, and that statement makes sense because, well, yes, they were put under different tensions then, and no two were really 100% alike. And then the other, you know, then that evolves into being a deep drawn shell. And what a deep drawn shell is, and I think we did deep drawn from like the late 80s throughout the 2000s. Or no, I think when we started in the 2000s, that's when we did deep drawn, and that lasted maybe until like 2011, 2012.
Okay.
And what deep drawn is basically you take a flat sheet of metal and you form it into, you press it into different cavity depths. So you press it once into one cavity depth, you move that same block of material into another cavity depth so that you can further draw it down or punch it downward until you get to your final depth. So obviously for like a five, you probably don't have that many processes, but for a 6.5, you would have a few more. That's the way it was explained to me. I wasn't around to see that's the way they did it. But our supervisor that's in charge of metal shell operations in Monroe kind of broke it down to me. And I was like, huh, that's kind of cool. Cause I've always heard it described as spun deep drawn. And I'm like, so the way you're explaining it, they're completely two different processes. It's not the same thing. He's like, yeah, I don't know why they would put those two together. Cause the operations are completely different. I was like, huh, interesting. So there could be people that do a combination of both, but the way we've done it, it was either one or the other.
So just to picture it, they heat it, obviously, and then just like push it into a mold.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then if it, so maybe like you said, a 6.5, you can't stretch it that far without compromising the, you know, the metal. So then
exactly.
You stretch it back the other way. Okay, yeah. That's cool.
And what hydroforming does is basically it puts it, it takes the same thing. You start with a flat slab of brass, and you put it over a cavity. And this one, it, because of the strength of hydroforming, you can do it in one shot. So I've seen this done. I've witnessed it with my own eyes. And basically, it's this massive machine with I don't know how many tons of pressure this thing can put out, but it definitely can crush your skull without even any effort. But anyway,
that's good to know.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, this thing, they call it the skull crusher. No, this machine basically takes this blank and just basically shoves it in one shot into shape, and it's like, holy smokes, did that just happen?
Wow.
Yeah. And it's funny because when you see the spun process, like it makes that look so primitive and it takes forever. Yeah. So when you hydroform, the great benefits from hydroforming are not only in the integrity of the shell, but it also improves your product yield, and you're producing a lot more product a lot quicker, which is great because the demand for this drum hasn't gone away. I mean, we sell boatloads of these year after year. And the great thing about today's drums is our lead times are much more reduced. The consistency and the roundness of these are far greater than ever before because they do an annealing to the material, which is basically, it's kind of like a temperature cure, the way it was explained to me. And it basically ensures that the alloy is formed at a regulated consistent temperature from start to finish.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And so today you can pull, you know, you can go to any drum shop that's got, you know, 2 6.5 by 14s on the shelf, pull one and pull the other, and they're going to sound the same, which is great too. And the reason why that principle is so valuable today, when you're a touring drummer, you best practices is to take a spare, right? Mm-hmm. And you want your spares to not be significantly different than your main. I mean, you just want it to be exactly what it normally is supposed to be. And the cool thing is with today's snare drums, because of the consistencies in our manufacturing processes, there is no difference between the sound of your A Black Beauty and your B Black Beauty.
Yeah. As opposed to before where it's like, whoa, those are completely different.
Yeah,
drums.
Yeah. Like, I'm sure there was times where like an engineer is like, what the hell did you do? And it's like, it's the same drum. It's like, no, it's not.
You know? No, it's different. It was not consistent. So what is, so it's hydra or hydroform?
Hydroform.
Well, I'm trying to think, like, what is that? So what does hydro mean in that? Do you know like, what that would actually...
I think that has something to do with the skull crusher machine I'm talking about. Like,
gotcha.
It's like, okay. It's a hydraulic type of machine.
Oh, hydro.
Yeah,
duh.
Yeah.
Duh, that makes sense. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's good to know they're more consistent now and all that good stuff. So that's really cool to know those different, you know, that it's evolved over the years. And... So like I was saying before, where people say they want the really old ones, but maybe the tack weld ones really aren't what you want. You'd want like, if I guess the new ones are really, you know, if you're recording and gigging, that's probably what you want, is like a nice consistent one that has the hydro form as opposed to even the spun, which could be less consistent as well.
Oh yeah. Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And that's kind of the thing, you know, going back and you know, my notions on it are not to dog, you know, a vintage drum in any case.
Oh, no,
I'm a vintage guy myself. We're all, you know, we all have a deep appreciation for this stuff. But, you know, some of the headaches that I get, that I'm sure many people get with vintage gear sometimes, is like, it tends to do one thing and one thing really well. And when you find the drum, it probably does that one thing really well. But if you wanted a drum that you could really push to endless limits, you know, that might not be the drum, but drums today, it's just like anything else, like cars. You know, you look at, you know, technology in the automotive industry, you know, so on and so forth. It's like everything has evolved to maximize and amplify the integrity and the operation of that, unit, right? And that's basically where we are with drum manufacturing. You know, we've evolved from a lot of the primitive understandings and approaches, and with great respect to that stuff, because without having done that, we wouldn't have been able to get to where we are today.
Yeah, which, so basically, since it came back in the 2000s, it's been available, correct? Like, it didn't go away again. It's been available since its arrival back in the 2000s, right?
Correct. Yeah, so it's been available, and we've done quite a number of different things. Probably the other thing I should have mentioned about its reintroduction in the late 70s is that the format was consistent, mostly to 10 lugs, because that was, or only to 10 lugs, because that was the format for Superphonics, and things like that. And as time went on, that tended to be the preferred and consistent format. However, the drums of the 20s were mostly 8 lugs. They did make some 10 lug versions, but majority of them were 8 lugs. And by the 2000s, you know, we kept that same format, you know, throughout the late 70s, 80s as a 10 lug drum up until last year. Last year was Ludwig's 110th anniversary, which also coincided with the 100th anniversary of the Black Beauty, essentially the inspirational model, to be more specific. And, you know, throughout the 2000s, obviously we offered different versions of the 10-lug Black Beauty. There was a hammered version. We had a version with die-cast hoops. And, you know, we try to augment the shell a little bit. We do a lot of hammering in-house already for timpani. And you know, we started to do a lot of hammering for drums in the 80s and so on. And so when the Black Beauty came back, you know, we offered hammering on Super and Bronze, and of course we would offer that on Black Beauty and things like that. So you did have different flavors of the Black Beauty throughout the 2000s. Not only did it change in the manufacturing and what that did to the sound, but you also kind of had a different format that you can choose from. And what hammering does for many of you that may not know, hammering dries out the shell a little bit and adds a little bit more focus. You can kind of think about it as the same principle to, you know, in cymbal making. When they overhammer a cymbal, it's not as you know, it becomes a lot darker and drier, not as sizzly and you know, resonant, things like that. And same principle applies to hammering. I've also noticed hammering to also put an emphasis on the body, on the low end, which is kind of cool, especially on 5-inch drums, like 5-inch hammered Supras. That's like, if you haven't tried one of those, try one of those. They're pretty gnarly. Going back to the 10-lug Black Beauty, and, you know, we get to the anniversary of the 110th anniversary of Ludwig, and knowing that it coincided, you know, with the anniversary of the inspirational model, we sort of wanted to go back to that format, or a version of that format, not that format 100%, you know, with the tack, welded shell, things like that. But we went to an 8-lug format on brass, which we haven't done since the 20s. Cool. And then we did that with just a standard black nickel brass shell, and gold trim, just like the inspirational model. And again, those are probably the rarest of the Black Beauties, is those early inspirational models. I've only seen one in person, and I didn't even know what it was the first time I saw it. If we got a little bit of time, I could get into that story. Basically, the drum is Steve Albini's drum, and it lives at Electrical Audio, the studio. And yeah, I worked with Steve on repairing a few things for, you know, the shellac gear, and Todd Trainer is one of our artists, so that's how we're all connected. And I reside in Chicago, they're in Chicago, so on and so forth. But anyway, he one day I was at the studio, and he's like, "Hey man, the throw off on this drum doesn't work. I don't know what it is. Somebody that was here recording once, like in the 90s, went down the street to this thrift store and bought this drum for like $25 and came back and recorded on it and just said I could have it." And I looked at it and I was like, well, it's a Ludwig. I just don't know what, because I've only, like, the only black nickel plated shells I'd ever encountered were a scrolled one or a nickel over brass drum. So I was like, I don't know what, like, there's no evidence that this was painted over, the scrolling or whatever. And then finally, I got some of the early 20s catalogs, and I was like, oh, holy smokes. Like, this is one of the early ones. And
you paid $25?
Yeah, $25, dude.
Like, oh, my God.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. I was like, dang, that's awesome. And I ended up kind of rigging a throw-off that works from a contemporary piccolo throw-off that we have. But it was really cool to like hold one of those and play it. But he says that drum gets used a ton. He's like, yeah, people just flip out about this drum. I never knew what it was. And then finally, I found out what it was. And I was like, oh, it turns out it's this. And it's pretty cool that you got it.
God. And you said it was the Inspiration model. So it was the early, early, early.
Yeah. So it was, you know, something from 1919 or, you know, from 1919 to 1926, whenever that stuff was made.
Being used at that studio. I've seen videos of his studio and it's just like, it's such a cool place. You're lucky you get to hang out there too. That's awesome. So that's actually a perfect segue because I was going to ask you as we kind of get close to the end here. So has it always been this drum of like legend that is so collectible and everyone wants it? Did that start in the last 20 years or is that always been the case?
I think it always was the case, but only grew to grander scale over the last 30 years, I'd say.
Gotcha.
Again, going back to, you know, all those records being cut in the 80s and things like that, and people like freaking out about like those sounds and those tones and things like that. It was on a lot of stuff when you think about it, you know.
Definitely.
It's on, I think it was some of Ride the Lightning by Metallica. And Lars was using, I think it was the drummer from Def Leppard. It was his Black Beauty that he was using on that. You know, as I mentioned, Topper Heating of the Clash used it. Chris Layton used it a lot with Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Yeah.
So you name it, man. It's on like deep blues cuts. It's on punk rock. It's on, you know, Wolf told me he used it on like one of the tracks with Celine Dion that went diamond or something. I was like, holy smokes. So like, yeah, if there's a drum Wolf that can get the job done, it's that one. And it has such a large fan base because there's no way that you can't get excited about talking about that drum or playing that drum. And when you hear like a specific performance or you're at a concert or hear a record and you nerd out over gear, it's like once you find out it's that drum, you're just fixated on it, you know?
And it's got that special something. I've never actually played one, but I have for multiple sessions had my snare supplemented, not replaced, but supplemented with like a slate trigger that is the Black Beauty setting or whatever.
Oh, cool.
So, you know, it's kind of a fake version, but at that, the one that was recorded was real. And then I just kind of use it to beef it up. But, that's so cool, man. Well, man, this has been awesome. So why don't you tell people a little bit about you? Cause I don't think we said it at the beginning, but you're the marketing and artist relations manager at Ludwig Drums. So you're living the dream, man.
Kind of. Yeah. Yeah. well, you know, I don't take it for granted. And I still sometimes pinch myself. Like, is this still reality? Again, I think I mentioned at some point in the podcast, you know, I grew up a drummer. I've been playing drums since I was 11. And growing up in Chicago, everyone has, you know, a very deep affinity and appreciation towards one of the local brands or manufacturers, you know, whether it's Slingerland, you know, or Ludwig, or I think Camco too was Oaklawn for a brief period. But for me, you know, I've always been a massive, huge fan of Ludwig just because of the connection. Like when you're from Chicago, you know, you're super proud to be from Chicago. Maybe because of the 90s Bulls, but no less, I came from being a massive fan. I became a massive fan of the brand, and it led to, you know, an obsession really of the brand and the history and the people behind it. Once I really start to learn the story of the people behind the brand, that's when my appreciation for this brand grew even deeper. And I just try to surround myself as much as I can with drums. And I took on a lot of different roles, whether it's, you know, teching, building my own drums to the point of starting a drum company before Ludwig called Damon Drums, which is named after the old Damon factory.
Yeah.
And, you know, working at drum shops that just specialize in selling Ludwig, like that was my game plan to do that. And, you know, I've worn many, many hats, and all of them thankfully involved drums and a lot of the times just Ludwig drums, which was the best part of it, you know, to the point where the doors opened and, you know, there was an extended invitation to join the team. And I couldn't have been more honored at the time. And even now, just to continue to do this, I got hired a little over 5 years ago as the artist relations manager. And having such a deep appreciation and knowledge of the brand, knowledge of drums and drum building and things like that, I started to take on a lot more responsibilities just out of passion. You know, I was really excited to be involved as much as I could. And I worked with a great team that really embraced having me and having my input and valued that. But also the community also really embraced me just as much as we embraced them. And that really helped, you know, catapult things and move things to where they are today. We get to see really cool things come to fruition and come to market, like, you know, an 8-lug Black Beauty and things like that. And there's a lot of cool stuff on the way. You know, we've kind of it's cool because this brand's definitely turning a new chapter, and I think it's going in the right direction. We have a lot of the continued support and the loyal fan base. And as I mentioned before, you know, the main ingredient in our recipe is to put the people first. You know, they steer the ship. They kind of inspire us on where we need to go throughout this whole thing. And it's just been really cool. The guys on the inside are great. Guys on the outside are the biggest inspiration. Obviously, guys and girls. Sorry, I'm just kind of using that term.
Oh yeah, no,
loosely, obviously, yeah. But it's been a wild ride, man. I don't think I would have ever thought I'd possess a key to a drum factory, no less the Ludwig drum factory.
So, literally.
Yeah, no, it was insane. Like, I remember when I put it on, I was just like, this isn't reality. Like, when is this dream over? Like, what's going on? That's awesome. It's cool. You know, and things like the Speed King are back and, you know, playing a role in redesigning a box for that. Like, that was mind blowing. Like,
I love that.
Yeah. At every point, it's just been, crazy. But it's all been super exciting. And again, one of the biggest things, you know, one of the funnest parts of this job is the community, interacting and building relationships with people like yourself, players, educators, and everything, because, you know, we all know why we're musicians and the impact that music has. And I think we all do everything that we can to advocate and support for one another, which is really cool. The camaraderie just always blows me away, especially, you know, now that we're sort of undergoing a lot of these very difficult and unfamiliar times, you know. Seeing everybody band together in unique ways and continue to support each other is 100% important, but also very heartwarming at the same time and very inspiring. So it's cool to be able to blend a lot of elements and activity in drum manufacturing that are responsible for uplifting a lot of people and communities of people. And that's what's really cool, I think, at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And just to put a date on this episode, we are like in the middle of like being quarantined with like the coronavirus and not leaving our houses and stuff. Yeah. So if you listen to this 10 years from now and, you know, you forget when it was, just remember, we can't leave our homes right now.
And we don't have the McRib or the Shamrock Shake right now.
No, and it's a shame.
This has been McDonald's has gotten a mad plug at this episode.
Everyone's like gonna like sneak out and try and see if they can get some McRibs.
Hey, we're not supporting McDonald's.
No, it's not about them. It's about Ludwig. But yeah, man, everything that's been going on with the new stuff, the new Speed King, everything is really cool. And I think having a guy like you involved who's younger and just really in tune with the next generation of drummers, it's not like a thing where, I don't know, it's not like it's gotten old and stuffy. It's still very new and fresh and cool. So I think everyone's really happy that you're there and you're working on stuff and keeping the brand fresh. And man, I really appreciate you taking the time to be on the show. And you did a great job explaining through all the like the tack weld, the spun, and the hydro. Like, it was very clear, and I really appreciate that.
Cool. Yeah, absolutely. I'm always happy to do it. I know that a lot of this information isn't so easily accessible and there isn't one destination for it. So to be able to sort of sum it all up in one place was really, really cool. Really fun. Obviously, anytime I get to talk gear and the gears start spinning, you know, no pun intended.
Yes.
You know, that's where I want to be, you know, and so it was perfect. Big shout out to Stephen Wolf for making the connect.
Yeah. No, he's unbelievable. And just like, so Wolf, like he reached out to me after like three episodes when there was just, I mean, people had heard it, but I mean, that's like three episodes. I'm on episode 40 when I'm recording this right now. So, I mean, he called me and it was like midnight, because you know how he is. He's a vampire. And so just to talk to him on the phone, I was like, holy crap, this is unbelievable. You're a famous drummer. And it really helped me keep going, just to be like, all right, people actually like this. So
I'm glad to see this take off at the level that it has. I mean, it's definitely, you're the right person for this. I mean, you have such a passion for it and for drums in general. And that's what that's the kind of person that you need behind something like this. So thanks for what you're doing for the community and for the fan base that you have now, but also for, you know, the people that are going to come across this in the next few months and years. This is really critical. Like I said, a lot of this information is really critical and it doesn't exist you know, a lot of accessible ways, and you're doing that. You're making it accessible, which is awesome, you know, and you're putting, you know, your spin on it, you know, talking to different people and personalities that bring a different color to things and excitement, and things like that. So I'm super stoked to do this. And obviously, you know, being a 111-year-old company, there's tons of product and history to talk about. So yes. I'm down to do, yeah. I mean, we can pick a product, you know, whenever. I know Wolf is down to do some and stuff. So this could be cool.
It's so cool. Thank you very much for what you said. And exactly, you're right. Where like, so Vincent Leaf, before he did the Speed King episode, which we'll have to retouch on because there's a new one, but we could do the Acrolyte, we could do the Superphonic. I mean, the Acrolyte alone, I think Wolf and I might do that because he's taking that, you know, student model drum and playing on platinum selling albums.
Oh,
and,
yeah. He loves that drum.
Yeah. That's another episode. But yeah man.
Without doubt.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. And where can people find you? Let's say that. Where can they find you if they want to follow you and all that good stuff?
Yeah, definitely. You could find me. You know, all my antics and goofiness is all on Instagram for the most part at Damon Drums. And obviously definitely follow at Ludwig Drums HQ if you're not on Instagram and Facebook. Obviously visit our site ludwig-drums.com to keep up to date with a lot of our product releases. We do some blogging on there as well, you know, do some artist coverage, product coverage, things like that, talk about some shops. Awesome to engage with people when we can. And super, super proud to always have, you know, the consistent loyal fan base for Ludwig. And I'm one of those fans as well.
Awesome. Cool. Uli, thanks so much for being on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, without a doubt. Thank you for having me.
If you like this podcast, find me on social media at Drum History and please share, rate, and leave a review. And let me know topics that you would like to learn about in the future. Until next time, keep on learning. This is a Gwyn Sound podcast.